All right, ready to dive deep into something big?
Let's do it.
Today, we're tackling the British legal system in India during those colonial times.
A fascinating period for sure.
Definitely. And you've given us some seriously in-depth scholarly works to dig into, so.
Oh, yeah, we're going to uncover some things.
Big time. We're going to see how that colonial justice system actually worked, how racial discrimination, you know, was just built right in. And then the aftershocks that are still rippling through India today.
It's interesting how so often that period is seen as just over and done with. But the reality is it's so intertwined with India today, legally, socially.
Totally. Okay, so first let's set the scene a little. It's the late 1700s, and the East India Company, well, they're figuring out that just trading isn't enough anymore. They're starting to govern. But here's the catch. They're basically clueless about India beyond, you know, the business stuff.
It's almost funny when you think about it. These company guys, barely speaking the languages, and their experience with empire, more like pushing out indigenous people, not governing them.
Right. What a mess waiting to happen. Talk about a recipe for disaster, for governing this massive and complex place.
You can say that again.
It makes you wonder, like, did they even bother reading a history book?
Right.
And even back then, you had people like Edmund Burke, a British politician, calling them out, saying, hey, you need to be trustees for the people of India, not just exploiters.
And that gets to the heart of it, right? This clash between Western legal ideas and the reality of Indian society. They came in with these notions about property rights, individual ownership, a centralized system, expecting it to just fit.
But of course, India had its own systems already running. Things that didn't exactly match up with those ideas. It's like trying to force, I don't know, a square peg into a round hole.
Exactly.
So was there any attempt to, like, bridge that gap at all?
Well, their solution, more like reshaping the hole instead of changing the peg, you know, and a prime example, the Cornwallis Code of 1793. Think of it as their big attempt to make Indian land ownership more, well, British, with the defined plots and all.
Sounds simple enough on the surface, but I have a feeling it wasn't that smooth.
You'd be right. It totally missed the nuances of land ownership in India. Rights were spread out, you know, cultivators, villages, elites. It was complicated. Not just one person owning one plot.
So this code, meant to bring order, probably caused more chaos and dispossession.
Yeah, you got it. And one major outcome, the zemindari system becoming official. Local landlords, the zemindars, got ownership rights and had to collect taxes. Sounds okay, maybe, but...
Okay, let me guess. Another good intention gone wrong.
Sadly, yeah. This change had huge consequences. The zemindari system made peasants, basically, tenants at will, vulnerable to being taken advantage of, even evicted.
It's wild how these policies, even with good intentions, could backfire so badly.
It really shows you have to understand the place before making big changes.
A cookie-cutter approach just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can't forget about the elephant in the room here.
Oh, absolutely.
Racial discrimination.
Yeah. It wasn't just imposing a system. It was that the system itself was stacked against Indians right from the start.
So it wasn't a fair playing field at all. This had to create some resentment.
Oh, tons. And that discrimination, reinforced by laws and regulations specifically designed to disadvantage Indians. Take how taxes were collected, for example. A lot of people saw it as deeply unfair, taking advantage.
So not just the laws themselves, but how they were enforced. Who benefited?
Exactly. But in all of this, it's important to remember that Indians weren't passive. They resisted this system in lots of ways.
Oh, yeah. Tell me more about it. How did they push back?
Well, despite the obstacles, they found ways. Literary societies, newspapers, political organizations, all to advocate for their rights and challenge British policies head on.
So even in this oppressive system, there were these seeds of resistance.
Absolutely. Groups like the Indian Association in Calcutta and the Pune Sarvajanik Sabha, they were vital, mobilizing people, demanding reform. The early stages of the Indian nationalist movement, you could say.
It's like the system, by being so oppressive, accidentally fueled the movement for independence, by creating this shared experience, this desire for self-rule.
That's a great point. The experience of colonial justice, with all its unfairness, played a huge role in uniting Indians from all over.
So this wasn't just some legal debate. It was about power, identity, controlling your own destiny.
Exactly.
Before we move on, can we focus on one part of this system? I'm really interested in how they imposed Western legal norms, especially with property rights. It feels like that's where British ideas really clashed with what was already happening in India.
Yeah, you're right. The British came in with this very specific view of property. You know, individual ownership, clear boundaries, being able to buy and sell land freely, concepts that didn't really fit with how things worked in India.
Can you give us some real-life examples of how this played out?
Sure. Let's look at Bengal, where the British first got their foothold. Before they came, land rights were complicated, with lots of overlap. Cultivators had rights to work the land, zamindars collected revenue and kept things in order, and the state took its share. It was all connected, no single owner.
And then the British marched in and tried to untangle all of that, to impose their system.
Right. They wanted it simple, manageable, according to their rules. And that's how we got the permanent settlement of 1793.
Ah, yes, the permanent settlement. Wasn't that supposed to create stability and encourage investment?
That was the plan. Fix the revenue zamindars had to pay, hoping they'd improve their land and increase productivity. Sounded good, right?
On paper, yeah. But we've learned by now that things rarely go to plan. So what went wrong this time?
For one thing, the revenue they set, way too high. More than zamindars could collect from the cultivators, it forced many into debt and led to land being sold off.
Oh, the irony. But hold on, didn't the permanent settlement also impact the cultivators themselves?
You're right. It totally ignored their rights. They became tenants at will, meaning they could be charged high rents and evicted whenever the zamindar felt like it.
So trying to create a system based on individual ownership actually ended up disenfranchising most people.
Yeah, that's one way to put it. It made things worse, not better. Agricultural productivity went down. Rural Bengal became more impoverished. A stark reminder that good intentions can have really bad consequences when you don't understand the context.
It's fascinating how what we're talking about isn't just ancient history. It still affects India today.
It does. And that's why it's so important to really understand this history, the complexities, and how it all plays out even now.
Agreed. We've covered a lot, so let's pause here for now. We'll continue this in our next installment.
Sounds good. We've got a good foundation, but there's so much more to explore. So we were talking about how those early days in Bengal, you know, really show how imposing a system without understanding the local context can backfire big time. But did the British, like, learn from those early stumbles? As they expanded their control, did their approach change at all?
Right. Did they adjust course? Did they get it?
It's kind of a mixed bag, to be honest. There were attempts, sure, but they often fell short. It's like they couldn't quite let go of this idea that their way was the only right way, you know, the superior way.
Ah, that classic British exceptionalism. So what did this learning and adapting, as you say, look like in practice?
Okay, so when they went into southern India, they ran into the Rayatwari system. Now remember, in Bengal, they set up that zamindari system with the landlords in the middle, but with Rayatwari, it was the cultivator, the Rayat, who was considered the owner. They paid taxes directly to the state, no zamindar involved.
Okay, interesting. So they kind of skipped the whole landlord thing. Is that because they, like, recognized the problems that zamindari caused?
Yeah, partly. They saw Rayatwari as more equitable, like it was giving power to the cultivators and would lead to a more prosperous agriculture. They thought, this is it. We've got it this time.
Okay, so did it work? Did Rayatwari live up to their hopes?
Not really. It did avoid some of the zamindari issues, but it wasn't perfect, you know? Taxes were still pretty high, and the system wasn't flexible enough to handle things like, say, a bad harvest. Cultivators could still end up in debt.
It sounds like that obsession with revenue, it was hard for them to shake off, no matter the system.
Exactly. India was a cash cow for their imperial ambitions, you know? That drove so much of their approach to governing.
And it wasn't just taxes either, right? You mentioned earlier that they brought in laws that basically criminalized a lot of traditional Indian practices and customs.
Yeah.
Can you talk more about that?
Absolutely. Let's look at forestry, for example. For centuries, Indian communities depended on forests for, well, pretty much everything. Timber, fuel wood, other resources. It was a way of life, their connection with nature.
But I'm guessing the British, with their focus on profit, saw those forests in a very different light.
You got it. They saw dollar signs, basically. Raw materials for their industries, a source of revenue. So they came up with these forest acts that restricted access and slapped on big fines if you broke them.
So something that was once a shared resource, a way of life for generations, suddenly became a crime.
Pretty much, yeah. These forest acts had a terrible impact on rural communities. They lost their traditional ways of making a living. A lot of people were forced into poverty. Just another example of the British imposing their ideas, this time about property and resources, on a society that had its own systems already working.
It's like they were trying to remake India in Britain's image, you know? imposing their own idea of order, ignoring centuries of history, culture, knowledge that existed in India before they even set foot there.
Right. It's like they couldn't grasp the idea that different doesn't mean worse, that arrogance, that feeling of superiority, it fueled so much injustice during colonial rule.
It's all connected, isn't it? The need for money, the racial biases, that cultural arrogance. No wonder people in India eventually rose up and demanded their freedom. But before we get to that, I want to go back to something you said earlier. How Indians responded to this legal system. You talked about their resistance, but I'd love to hear more about how they challenged it, even subverted it, and eventually how they changed it.
It's a story of resilience, really, and resourcefulness. The responses were so diverse. One thing they did was engage with the British legal system, but strategically, you know, using the system's own tools and procedures to fight for their rights, kind of like playing the game, but making their own moves.
So they learned to fight fire with fire, in a way. Did that actually work?
It wasn't easy, that's for sure. And it wasn't fast. But those challenges, those legal battles, forced the British to make some concessions over time. Some laws got reformed. Indians got a little bit more of a voice within the system. It wasn't about completely overthrowing it right away, but about slowly chipping away at the injustices.
So it was a two-pronged approach, right? Protests and resistance outside the system, and then working from within to push for change.
Exactly. That combo, the legal stuff and the broader social movements, that was a powerful force in the fight for independence. But legal challenges, they were just one part of the story. Indians also created their own legal institutions, you know, their own ways to resolve disputes based on their own traditions, running parallel to the British system.
Wow, so they were running their own show alongside the colonial one. That's fascinating. Tell me more about these parallel systems.
Think of it as like legal pluralism. Different systems all working together, interacting. These alternative systems were often rooted in traditional panchayats, those village councils or caste-based councils. It was a way for communities to handle their own conflicts based on their own customs and values.
So how did these systems actually work? What were their guiding principles?
The details varied, of course, depending on the community and the situation. But a lot of them focused on finding consensus on mediation, restorative justice. Less about punishment, more about restoring harmony within the community.
It sounds like a very different approach from those adversarial British courts. More focused on relationships, not just assigning blame.
Exactly. And these systems were also more adaptable, more flexible to the needs and customs of different communities. You could almost see them as like early versions of modern-day alternative dispute resolution.
So it wasn't just about resolving disputes. These systems probably helped to keep communities strong and preserve cultural identity, right?
Absolutely. They were a buffer against that homogenizing force of British law, helping to protect the diversity of Indian society.
It's inspiring to see how, even under colonial rule, Indians found ways to hold on to their own legal and cultural traditions.
It really shows their resilience and ability to adapt. And these parallel systems, they would go on to influence the legal landscape of an independent India as a whole other chapter.
And on that note, I think we're ready to move to that next phase of our deep dive, exploring how colonial justice left its mark on independent India. The story doesn't end with independence, does it?
No way. That colonial legal system might be gone, but its influence, it's still there, deeply woven into the fabric of Indian society, like a ghost that lingers in the halls of justice.
I'm ready to uncover those lingering influences and understand how India dealt with this inheritance. That must have been quite a challenge. So we've spent this deep dive really digging into that British legal system in India, you know, during those colonial times, unpacking all the complexities, the contradictions.
Right, seeing how those Western legal ideas didn't always mesh with existing Indian practices.
And how that discrimination, that racial discrimination, was just built into the system.
And we talked about how Indians fought back, you know, challenging the system, creating their own systems based on their traditions.
Right, resisting. But now, let's jump ahead. It's 1947, British rule is over, and India is independent. What happens to that colonial legal system that had been woven into the fabric of their society for so long?
That's the big question, isn't it? How a nation rebuilds, redefines itself after being under colonial rule for so long? Do you just toss it all out and start over?
It's tempting to think so, right? After all that injustice, all the exploitation.
You'd think so, but it's never that simple, is it?
Never is.
There was that desire to break free, absolutely. But there was also that understanding that just erasing the whole legal system would create chaos. They had to find a way to adapt it to the needs of a new, independent, democratic India. A huge task, like, you know, renovating a house while you're still living in it.
So where do you even begin with a task like that? What were their priorities?
Well, one of the big ones was dealing with the legacy of things like the zamindari system, all those inequalities in land ownership. A lot of states passed zamindari abolition acts to try and redistribute land to cultivators and weaken the hold of landlords.
That sounds like a huge step towards justice. Did it work?
It was a step in the right direction, definitely. But land reform, it's never easy. These reforms, they met resistance, pushback from those who benefited from the old system. Trying to change those deep-rooted power structures, that's a long and complicated
It
process.
must have been. But besides those reforms, they also needed to create a whole new legal framework, something that reflected India's values as an independent nation.
Exactly, and that's where the Indian Constitution comes in. Adopted in 1950, it's a remarkable document, guaranteeing fundamental rights to everyone, no matter their background. A statement that everyone's equal under the law.
Wow, what a shift from those days of discrimination and double standards under the British. The Constitution, it feels like a huge step forward.
It was a landmark moment, and the Constitution also created an independent judiciary, their job, to protect those fundamental rights and uphold the rule of law.
So they were building a new system while still dealing with, like, the ghosts of the colonial one.
Right, and those ghosts, well, they're still present in some ways. The court structures, the language used, even some of the basic legal principles, they all carry that mark of British rule.
It makes you think, can you ever truly get rid of that colonial legacy, even after independence?
That's a question that's still being debated today, and it's fueled a movement to decolonize the legal system.
Decolonize. Okay, I'm curious, what does that actually mean in practice?
It's about looking critically at those colonial foundations and finding ways to make the system more responsive to the needs and aspirations of the Indian people. Not just erasing the past, but transforming the present, shaping a future that's based on India's own values, their own vision of justice.
So, reclaiming their legal identity, you could say, making sure the pursuit of justice is fair and inclusive for everyone.
Yes, exactly. And it's an ongoing process, always evolving as India faces new challenges.
And that's what's so interesting about all of this, right? We're not just talking about some dusty history here. We're talking about power, about identity, about what justice means in a world after colonialism. It's a story that resonates with so many people who have grappled with the impact of colonial rule.
It's a universal story in many ways. The search for justice is never truly over. It's something that requires constant work, reflection, transformation.
Well said. And on that note, I think we've reached the end of our deep dive. It's been quite a journey exploring this part of history.
A complex and impactful part of history, for sure, and one that continues to shape the world we live in.
And as we wrap up, we'll leave you with some things to think about. How do countries truly decolonize their systems, but also keep the things that worked? What can we learn from history about the dangers of imposing ideas on other cultures? And how do we make sure the pursuit of justice includes everyone, truly?
Important questions indeed. It's a conversation we should all be part of.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into colonial justice and its legacy in India. Until next time, keep those minds curious and open to the complexities of our shared history.